Genesis 32:1-21. Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is the camp of God." So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my master Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, men servants and maid servants. Now I am sending this message to my lord, that I may find favour in your eyes." When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, "If Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is my left may escape." Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, and O Lord, who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, 'I will surely make you prosper, and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" He spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds." He instructed the one in the land, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you going, and who owns all these animals in front of you?' then they are to say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us.'" He also instructed the second, the third, and all the others who followed the herds. They are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him, and be sure to say, "Your servant Jacob is coming behind us." For he thought, "I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will receive me." So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp.
Thanks, Emily. Right. Good evening. Oh, hello. Steve Wood wants me to keep him awake, because he's a bit tired. There you go. Hello, Steve. And the students have got a film night, so I've got to remember to end with that in mind. But, blessed be your name, huh? It's an entirely countercultural song, isn't it? You give and take away. My heart will choose to say, blessed be your name. That is not a song that our culture is singing. I suggest to you that it is a song that only believing people can sing. And I think we sung it with great meaning and as an offering to the Lord. So we're looking at Jacob, and we're seeing how God lovingly yet painfully masters his people. And it's very important for us to understand that there's a process going on here. And we will not climax that process this evening. We need to get to verses 22 to 32 of Genesis 32. And we will see the joyful climax that comes as God truly masters his servant and wrestles him to the ground. And we're not finished even when we get there, because actually we need to think through about Jesus being our firstborn, the one who was lovingly and painfully broken for us, that we might indeed enjoy a relationship with God forever and forever. But nonetheless, let's continue with this process that God is in fact bringing about in Jacob's life. You see, self-fulfillment is everything, isn't it? It is indeed one of the massive, powerful cultural influences of our day. As long as we are happy, successful, healthy, wealthy, and in control of our lives, then everything's okay. Lifestyle is God. The slogan that I saw on a shop, I think, might summarize some of it. Good things happen to those who don't wait. And that thinking is so powerful, isn't it? It matches the natural sinful desires of our hearts. The thinking, therefore, is not new, is it? It's as old as Genesis, and it's as old at least as Jacob. Jacob, who wanted to be the firstborn, and bought it with a bowl of soup. Jacob, who conned the blessing out of Isaac, which was supposed to go to Esau, a material blessing full of land and riches. Self-fulfillment was at the heart of what Jacob was doing. It had started in the womb, as you know, as he had a punch-up with his brother Esau. He failed to be the firstborn, but that was his heart's desire, even as an embryo. Yet we were reminded, weren't we, on Wednesday evening by Christian Concern that the me life has a dark and deadly side to it. Don't know about you, but Wednesday night came as a tidal wave all over my soul. As sinful self-fulfillment hit us afresh. The dark side that is hidden by the cultural vibrancy. Yes, life is exciting and it's to be enjoyed. And don't want you to take anything out of that that's not there. But there is a dark side. And sometimes in our Christian subculture, we need to get hold of that reality. For sometimes we have buried our heads in the sand. Now maybe you're in the workaday world and you haven't buried your head in the sand, and that's fine if you haven't. But I suspect that many of us in our Christian subculture have done exactly that. And sometimes we wake up and realize there is something out there that is massively destructive. Having said that, we do have a theology of creation, don't we? We do want to glorify God and enjoy Him in His good gifts culturally and in creation. So I don't want you to miss that by what I'm about to say in terms of a conversation that I heard about. It's a conversation between a Christian and a friend. The friend who was rejecting Christianity. And I think the friend had some understanding of Christianity also. The friend makes an overstatement. There's enough truth in what he says, they say, but it's not the whole truth. But here's the conversation, and you'll see why I want to give you this conversation. Christian, have you ever thought of having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? Friend, I am not convinced about the truth of Jesus Christ as I have watched Christians live. Christian, why is that? Friend, you Christians do not really think that Jesus is worth following. Christian, why do you say that? Friend, you Christians believe that the truly fulfilled life is outside of Jesus. Your attitude to lifestyle is the same as everybody else's. We think material lifestyle is everything, and so do you. Christian, surely Christians are allowed to enjoy good things from God. Friend, yes, but if you lost all of them, would your Jesus be enough? Bit of a punch there, isn't there? Well, I have to say to you, this is where God is taking Jacob. He is taking Jacob on a journey, on a process, from self-fulfillment to God fulfillment. And I say to you, my friends, that that is relevant for us this evening, for it is the very same process that God is taking us on. From self-fulfillment and believing that life is all about being happy in me, to God fulfillment and being happy in God through Jesus. So as somebody has said, quote, as many have learned and later taught, you don't realize God or Jesus is all you need until God or Jesus is all you have. And I say to you, that's exactly where God will put Jacob, but not this evening. But we will get there whenever I return to Genesis 32. So let me see this process and say three things to you this evening. Notice with me, firstly, God's sure presence in verses 1 to 2 of Genesis 32. There are two truths that I said to you last week we must always hold on to if we are going to be steady under pressure. One, we must always study the sovereignty of God. He is the sovereign Lord over this story, and he keeps intruding in it throughout it. We find him right at the beginning when the boys are having this fight within the womb, and Rebekah actually inquires of the Lord, 25:23, and we're told that God is able to explain to her what's going on. There are two nations within her womb. They're struggling with each other, and the older will serve the younger. You already know what's going to happen before the end of the story, because God is sovereign. Now that is really very important, because why does God decide that it should be Jacob who is to be the firstborn, if you like, though he isn't actually the firstborn? Why all the blessing is going to come through him and not through Esau? What determines the choice of God? Romans chapter 9. This is why you study the sovereignty of God, because the sovereignty of God has at its very heart his mercy and his grace. Look at verse 10 of Romans 9. Not only that, but Rebekah's children had one and the same father, our father Isaac. Yet before the twins were born, or had done anything good or bad, or in order that God's purpose in election might stand, not by works, but by him who calls, she was told, the older will serve the younger. Just as it has written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. Of course, God didn't hate in that extreme sense. It was it's just a setting up of a startling contrast between the two. So there's the first truth. You must always study the sovereignty of God. Second truth you must always study in the light of it is this: the sinful mess that emerges as self-fulfillment is lived out under God. You must always study and expect a sinful mess. Because when you understand these two truths, you will know that God always keeps his promises, even though everything looks a mess. So on Wednesday evening, as I returned home in the car, I wasn't walking, I have to say that I was reflecting on both the sovereignty of God and the sinful mess that hit us afresh in very significant ways with Christian concern. Now you can say it's over the top and hope that it is, but it isn't. And those are the only two truths that you can really get hold of that help you in the middle of it all. And that's what you see. Well, okay. Moving the story on, Jacob's life is pretty good. He is the firstborn by buying it. He's got the material land blessings. He is wealthy. He has a large family. And now, verses 1 and 2 of chapter 32, he's got God in his life. Well, a bit of God in his life. Not too much, you know. You wouldn't want too much God, would you? You wouldn't want God taking over your life, would you? Oh, no. That's way too threatening. This is the God of Bethel in chapter 28, when Jacob was running away from his brother Esau and going to Laban. You remember he has this scene in Bethel where on a stone pillar he's lying asleep, and he sees this vision of angels descending and ascending on this stairway. And God makes certain promises to Jacob and tells him that he will come and bring him back to the land and fulfill the promises. But here is God now in this chapter 32, verses 1 to 2. And he's camping alongside Jacob. The Bible reminds us that in Psalm 34, verse 7, God does encamp around his people. In other words, God seems to have a mobile home. And he likes to assure his people of his protection. And therefore Jacob names this camp in the way that he does. It's literally meaning two camps, celebrating the divine presence alongside the human home. And Jacob can now go to the land and live happily ever after. It's all so nice, isn't it? But hang on a minute. Not happy with that. Surely all that sinful, self-fulfilled living cannot be justified by God, can it? All that scheming that this man has engaged in. Okay, under the sovereignty of God. But that doesn't justify the way he has sought to live. Yes, he's lived a life under God, but it's been mostly independent of God. He has lived a life under God, but it has been mostly independent of God. I met a Christian once and he assured me that he served God at weekends, which meant he came to church and he was very faithful in doing that, and that's good. I'm certainly not knocking that. But typical of me, of course, and never one to try to be popular, I asked him, well, what did you do the rest of the week? What was going on there? Were you not serving God the rest of the week? Did God not own the whole of your life? I said to the man. And there is a tendency, isn't there? That actually within our lives, there is a sense of, yeah, we have a dependence upon God when it suits us, but much of our life could be lived independently of God. The real decisions that are being made in our lives, diary decisions, wallet decisions, and many other decisions that we could mention, may be utterly independent of God and his word. And more importantly for Jacob, he was not in a position as a firstborn in Abraham's family to instruct the family to live according to God's saving purpose. The firstborn in Abraham's family wasn't just the first person to be born, though it was, but he had a responsibility spiritually and morally. And Jacob was in no position to do that. Look at Genesis chapter 18, verses 18 through 19. Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation. This is what the Lord says. And all nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him. So he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised to him. And I've done enough big picture that you should be able to remember what that's all about. And that's all about Jesus, and all about Jesus coming to produce salvation in the world so that people from the nations will be gathered to Christ and one day be gathered in the new creation. And I'm saying to you that Jacob is in no fit condition to teach his family about all those things. Because here is a man who has lived out a self-fulfilled life independent of God. No matter what the sovereignty of God is saying in terms of the outcome. And so God brings down the walls of independent, sinful living with regard to Jacob. The walls come crashing down. There's none of them left. And out of it will emerge a man with a glorious God-fulfilled life. We will get there and we will see it. That's what's going to happen. If God's great plan of salvation is to move forward. So God's sure presence Secondly, Jacob's move to reconcile, verses 3 to 6. The good, self-fulfilled life had one fly in the ointment, didn't it? If Jacob could get that sorted, then all would be well with his life. I don't know what the fly in your ointment is. And you might think, well, if I just got that one thing sorted out, it all would be rather good. And I could settle down and live my self-fulfilled life independent of God and bring God into my life just when I want him to become. Well, the fly in the ointment was Esau, Jacob's brother. 20 years earlier, you know, Jacob had conned Esau out of his blessing. The record is in chapter 27. Pretending to be Esau, Jacob went into the tent of Isaac and got the blessing while Esau was out hunting. When Esau discovered what had happened, this is what we read in chapter 27, verse 41. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." There's a lesson here, isn't there? The self-fulfilled life has a past. And that past is always got shame and guilt attached to it. Always. For Jacob to move forward into a truly God-fulfilled life, his past has to be repented of, and he must then for enjoy the amazing grace of God in relation to that. The past has to be repented of, if it hasn't been repented of. And we're going to see in chapter 32, 22 to 32, that God has not forgotten about chapter 27, and hasn't forgotten about all that deceit. For Jacob will have to face it when he thought he wouldn't have to. And it's part of God's love for Jacob. It is part of God's kindness to Jacob. It is part of God's commitment to Jacob that he does it. And if we have unrepented sin in our past, then my friends, I say to you, let's not self-justify. Let us be those who bow before the cross and cry out for forgiveness and cleansing, so that we might move on in God's grace into a maturer way of living. Well, Esau is living east of Canaan in the land of Seir, which means hairy, and in the nation of Edom, which means red, and you know that Esau was red and hairy, so where he lived matched his character. And Jacob sends a message that reaches out to his brother. It's got the right tone in it. It's full of respectful language. He says, my lord, and he calls himself my servant. You get this in 3 to 6. It's got the right truth in it. When he talks about the history of the last 20 years, he doesn't say, I'm running away from you, Esau, because you wanted to kill me. He said, I had to stay away. And remain with Laban. It's interesting, he just says it right, doesn't he? It's got the right length, it's short, but it's not self-justifying. And it's got the right aim, because he longs for Esau to extend the favor of grace in forgiveness to him. Here he is, he's got this self-fulfilled life, but he knows he's got a mess in it. And the mess that is coming towards him now and facing him is, of course, Esau and all connected with him. Can I say this to you, my dear friends? And I say it with all the love of my heart, believe it or not. I have met people who want the self-fulfilled mess sorted out, but they don't want the God-fulfilled life to replace it. Get me out of the mess, but I don't want to go towards God. And I've met Christians like that also. Well, this is maybe where Jacob is. He's quite prepared to get the mess sorted out, but not necessarily move towards God in any significant way where God would master his life. And we know that that's the case, because what's going to happen in 22 to 32 is absolutely climactic. And so, therefore, I am on the right lines as I say that. Well, the messengers return in verse 6 from Esau, and they say to Jacob, we went to your brother Esau, and now he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Well, there can only be one conclusion from that, and this was that it was an army going to destroy the family. So no wonder the text says that Jacob, in verse 7, was in great fear and distress. Though God is encamped alongside, and the word of promise has been revealed to Jacob on several occasions, fear dominates Jacob's heart. Did you notice that in the hymn, An Amazing Grace? Your grace taught my heart to fear, and then grace relieved the fear. Interesting that, isn't it? Grace teaches us to fear. Because when fear comes into your life and my life, that's really where we are. That's really where we are on the inside. The walls of self-trust and self-fulfillment that we have built up around us have now crashed. And in the rubble stands, in this case, a shaky Jacob, exposed and threatened. The dreams of self have now turned to the nightmare of death. So he had all these dreams, and they were amazing dreams, but all of them have gone. And of course, the nightmare, you know, in our dreams, often we have dreams and we, in our heads, and we have some great things going on. And the nightmare is if you lose them. What happens if I lose that thing that is so important to my life? And you feel a sense of fear going over your heart, don't you? Whatever that might be. There's just that sense of fear comes in, doesn't it? I don't want to be depressing you in any way, but let's be realistic here. And the fear tells you where your heart really is in terms of worship. Now, Jacob has true faith, and we will see that in a moment. There is some trust in his heart, but you need to understand this part of the story, that he is driven more by fear, and so therefore by self-trust. Because inevitably, my friends, fear will drive us into self-trust. We live in an age of great insecurities, don't we? I was going to ask you to start naming some of the insecurities of the day in which we live, but you can do that in your heads, and you can tell me afterwards if you want. Massive insecurities, aren't there? And all of those insecurities tell you exactly where people are. So, I've maybe told you this before, so I'll give you one example. I was on the train going from Liverpool to Hoylake on the Wirral, and it had been when there was a great tsunami. And there was people in the carriage talking about it. Well, obviously so. And at the end of every conversation, well, almost without exception, everybody turned to each other and said, but of course it could never happen here. And why did they say it? They said it because they were insecure about it. This is the age of power walks. This is the age of we know where we're going. We know where we'll be in 10 years' time. We've got it all mapped out. And yet there is massive insecurities. And there are insecurities in me too, by the way, just in case you don't know. How would our culture translate Proverbs 3, 5 through to 6? Trust yourself with all your heart and lean not to the understanding of God. In all your ways, submit to the powerful influence of self-fulfillment, and you will know the way to live. And we even have actually a theology that goes with that now, haven't we? We've got gospel, the prosperity gospel is basically, that's what it is. It's got a bit of Jesus in it, and there's a bit of a reference to God, but basically it's about self. So I'm saying to you, the fear factor in Jacob is the kind of fly in the ointment. It shows us where his heart is in all of this. And this attempt to reconcile is God's moment to really bring it all crashing down for good reasons. Finally, thirdly, the process of trusting God alone, verses 7 to 21, begins. He's moved by fear and self-trust. He's understandably going to scheme his way into self-preservation. Jacob is no fool. He is a very clever man. But I have to tell you, his scheming in these verses are all based on a faulty premise. It's all based on the premise that Esau is going to come and kill him. And Esau's not coming to kill him. Chapter 33 will tell you that Esau is coming to be reconciled to his brother. Now here's a big lesson here. And I have to tell you it because I know where our culture is generally, and sometimes church culture too. Here is Jacob and the absolute rightness of feelings. If you'd have said to Jacob, Esau's not going to kill you. He's actually going to be your friend. He'd have said, no, because I feel that that's not the case. You couldn't argue him out of it. We were travelling along once and we got lost. We didn't have a sat nav, we still don't. And the map wasn't proving too good. And then there was a cry from the back, maybe a frustration from some young son. I don't know which one it was. I feel we're in the wrong place. Well, what's that got to do with anything? We need objective truth to know whether we're in the wrong place or not. Keep your feelings to yourself. I'm trying to drive. We have to realize, my friends, that of course we have feelings and they are important, but they do not determine how we live our Christian lives. Listen to a very old hymn. Deep and unfathomable minds of never failing skill, God treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Blind unbelief is sure to err, be wrong, and scan God's work in vain. God is his own interpreter and he will make it plain. The process of trusting God alone is a process. You'll be glad to know that. I'm certainly glad to know it. But let's just see it as it works out, and then we're done. Jacob divides the camp in verse 8. The action is clearly, as I said, driven by fear. Verse 7 proves it. And he divides the camp into two. And his thinking is very sensible. If Esau comes and attacks one group, the other group that is left may escape. In this thoughtful action, he seeks to rebuild the walls of self-trust. He's doing something that will make a difference. Yet in reality, if Esau was going to come and kill him with 400 men, Jacob has no chance whatsoever. But he can pretend. It's all he can do. When you live independent of God, you have to live on your wits. You've got to outthink everything. You've got to be ahead of the game. You've got to hope you've got every angle covered. Because if you haven't, you're in trouble. So am I. So there's a divided camp. Then there is devoted prayer, verses 9 to 12. It's a real prayer. It's a prayer of genuine trust. It's a model prayer for us to follow. And yet I want you to know that although he prays the right things, the God-fulfilled life has not yet mastered him. It will take verses 22 to 32 in order for that to happen. But Jacob's heart goes out towards God, but is emotionally not there. Theologically, the mind is clear, as you will see in a moment or two, but the heart is not. So we ended this morning with a catechism. Two questions about comfort in God. Why did we end the way we did? Because I like catechisms. Well, not necessarily, but they do summarize truth for us in some very helpful ways. But although we could have chanted out the theological truth, this evening we may be no nearer comfort in God and confidence in Christ, because emotionally we're still not connecting to God and His grace. So it's not enough to pray the right words, though it is important to have the right words. And he had the right words, didn't he? Just see them with me. He refers to God in verse 9 as eternal, the God of covenantal promises. He speaks of the God of revealed truth who was spoken to him. The God of generous character in verse 10. He feels unworthy about the kindness and the faithfulness of God. He's the God of salvation because he says in verse 11, save me. And he's the God of purpose in verse 12, because all of this has to do with Abraham's family and God's great purpose for the world through Abraham. This is good praying. And yet, my friends, it doesn't really do anything for him until verses 22 to 32. I keep saying that, don't I? That's getting boring. Well, if there was devoted prayer, and there was devoted prayer, you see a divided heart, verses 13 to 21, and we're now almost done. Plan A might have been to trust in the sovereignty of God and what he had said. Plan B seemed to be another set of schemes. But actually, you have to say that Plan B, the schemes, were really Plan A. The desire to scheme is natural to Jacob and has long been the way that he has lived his life on the inside. And what is natural to us on the inside is how we live our lives. So the scheme is quite understandable. It's trying to buy the favor of Esau. The action is again thought out. There's gifts of animals, substantial gifts of animals, divided into three groups, and with a time interval between each. The leader of each gift herd is to say the same message when Esau asks who the herd belongs to. See, Jacob wants the giving and the messaging to be shouting loud that he's coming in a friendly fashion, desiring to reconcile with his brother. And verse 20 gives you the thinking behind all of the scheming. I will pacify him with these gifts I'm sending on ahead. Later when I see him, perhaps he will receive me. And I'm suggesting to you that on the basis of 9 to 12, where there was genuine prayer, and on the basis of 13 to 21, there is a divided heart. I'll trust in God, but I have to trust in myself too. I'll go with God, but as long as it agrees with me. So we have to pray, my friends, and I want us to end here, for undivided hearts. Hearts of wholehearted commitment to God, whatever the circumstances might be saying otherwise. Here are some verses from the Bible. Psalm 86, 11 to 13. Here's a prayer. Teach me your way, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart, that I may fear your name. I will praise you, O Lord my God, with all my heart. I will glorify your name forever, for great is your love towards me. You have delivered me from the depths of the grave. Undivided heart. Total commitment on the inside. None of this, I'll go with God, but I have to have a backup with regard to me. Or look at Proverbs 3, 5 to 6, which I corrupted earlier. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Learn from Jacob. Jacob's paths were crooked. They bent in all kinds of ways as he lived according to his wits. And yet the Lord says, if we trust in him and lean on his understanding, he will make our paths straight. Fear can drive us to God, my friends, but only persevering faith will keep us there. It is when we come before God in persevering faith and allow him to deal with our hearts that the self-fulfilled life is seen for what it is. It's just a folly and it's just empty. It may sound vibrant. It may even look exciting. But it isn't. It is here, as we will see in our next study, that the God-fulfilled life is known as greater, stronger, happier, and truly holier. It is here that indirectly we discover our joy as human beings. I think it was C.S. Lewis. I might be wrong. Who said, if you aim at happiness directly, you will never truly have it. It is only as you aim at holiness that you arrive indirectly at happiness. That's truly countercultural, isn't it? Hence, you need the promises, don't you? Standing on the promises. Because unless you have the promises of God, you can't have a persevering faith. Unless you have the promises of God, it makes no sense to trust God and learn that God-fulfilled life and keep moving away from that wretched condition of a self-fulfilled one. And when we do, let's go back to that conversation that we had as I finish. You remember the Christian and the friend? And the friend saying, you know, if you lost everything, your Jesus would not be enough. It's quite a challenge, isn't it? But if we know the God-fulfilled life, then I say to you, people will come to us and say something like this: you have the same lifestyle as me, but your contentment is most definitely not immaterial stuff. Or, you've gone through such pain in your life, but your life is still singing. Why are you still singing? Because the self-fulfilled life says you must be happy. And there is no room for suffering in the self-fulfilled life. And the issue that is often asked, why does God allow suffering, is coming from self-fulfilled cultures. If you read Keller on suffering, he will show you that actually historically, this is an aside, and it's just sprung to my head, but never mind. He says to us that actually there have been cultures in the past and indeed in the present who are training and teaching their people to learn how to suffer. It is the West that is going around saying, how can God allow suffering? Because we are committed to the idolatry of self-fulfillment. There you go. Let us pray.